Welcome back to Documentary First, an inside look at a first-time filmmaker's journey. I'm your host, Jason Rugg, filling in for Josh Lindsay, who's out sick today, and I'm joined, as always, by our first-time filmmaker herself, Christian Taylor. How you doing,
hey,
Christian?
Hey, Jason, I'm good. Thank you so much for being, our backup quarterback in this situation.
Yeah, happy to do it.
We have a special guest here today.
Yeah, we're joined again by George Ciampa, who was with us last week.
Yeah, last week George was here and he gave us such an incredible story. We just knew we had to have him back. We ended off at the Battle of the Bulge. So after a film update, we're going to hear some more from George. George, we're really happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, Christian, so let's dive into this film update. I want to hear what's going on.
Oh my gosh, it's been such an exciting, crazy week. I don't even know where to begin. So we did, sort of in our newsletter release that we had signed a deal with Delta, and that's just been super exciting among our donors, and we are thrilled about that. They have started fulfilling the distribution deliverables that Delta needs in order to get us on those planes by August. So that's great. And then I got news yesterday, which you are hearing it here first. We have had our official release in Canada. So yesterday, The Girl Who Wore Freedom was added to the Shaw Cable Company video on demand platform. So if you're listening and you live in Canada, go and check out The Girl Who Wore Freedom on your TV sets. You can watch it for $6.99 in HD. That's Canadian dollars. You can also go on the Cineplex store if you have a subscription to the Cineplex store. It's kind of like iTunes. We can be found there as well. For $5.99. So it's a little cheaper if you go to the Cineplex store than it is on Shaw Cable Company. But congratulations, Canada. You are now able to watch The Girl Who Wore Freedom.
Well, that's incredible.
Yeah, I know. It's super exciting. And then we're going to be sharing that on social media in the next few days. And our soft launch for the United States is coming up in a few days as well. We're going to do pre-sales on iTunes. So, everybody just needs to be looking out on our social media for that. So you'll know when you can share with your friends and tell them to go buy a copy of The Girl Who Wore Freedom. So that was great. Yesterday I was on WGN TV. Did you see that?
So I saw the Twitter update just a little bit too late. So I was like, you were like, I'm on in five. And it was like 3 hours ago for me. And I was like, no, I totally would have pulled that up. I can't believe I missed it.
Oh, well, that's okay. Actually, I missed it too. I don't know what happened. I was watching WGN online and I think I must've had an old cached version. It was replaying old news. So I missed it. But fortunately they sent out a link and they're carrying the interview online on WGN. So there is links on Twitter and on Facebook, and even LinkedIn, if you want to catch that interview. It's basically talking about our GI Film Festival debut, which is tonight. Of course, when everybody hears this, it'll be a week late. So, and by next week, we will know we are a finalist in the Best Documentary category, and we're a finalist in the First Time Filmmaker category. And that award ceremony is on Sunday. So by next week, we'll know. So that has just been an incredibly exciting thing. The last thing I have to tell you is I'm leaving this weekend to go meet a new director of photography, and I'm starting to interview for positions for the Brave Dutch. And I'm super excited about that because I realized what I'm going to do is, as The Girl Who Wore Freedom begins to wind down and the next project, The Brave Dutch, begins to wind up, we are going to close Documentary First and start Documentary Second. So I haven't told you that yet, Jason, but now you know.
Is that officially what it's going to be called? Yeah. Documentary Second?
Yeah. I mean, we might as well go with it, right? So that's what I've been thinking and dreaming about in regards to that. And we'll just kind of see how that goes. Also, new news on the Patreon front. I think we're going to be ready to launch our Patreon in the next week or two. And I'm so excited about this. We've now done the video. We've got all the tiers lined up. The levels and the rewards for those tiers are super fun. So I think people will like those a lot. So keep an eye out on our social media for when we launch our Patreon page.
Well, that's awesome.
Can I ask a question? What's the second documentary about?
Thank you, George. That's a wonderful question. It's called The Brave Dutch. And so it is the story of the Dutch resistance and how they helped our downed American airmen, British airmen, Canadian airmen, as well as the Jews and the underwater boys. Our particular story begins with John Lau, who was actually from my hometown of Laurel, Mississippi, and was shot down over occupied Holland in April of 1944. So John was kept alive for 11 months by the Dutch resistance. And when he got back to Paris, he wrote a little book, an homage to the brave Dutch people. So that is what the next documentary is about.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So any questions, Jason?
No, I think I'm just excited to see what this next week brings. Like, I'm excited to hear the update from next week, because it sounds like there's a lot of things that are going to be happening, like Patreon and award ceremonies and things within the next little bit here. So I'm excited to see what next week brings.
And our release. And, you know, if people are listening, don't forget, I'm going to be in Greenville, South Carolina on D-Day, which is June 6th. We've got the Reedy Reels Film Festival coming up. I'm going to be there with David Chapman and a few other people from our team. Then we're going to drive to Beaufort, South Carolina, beautiful Beaufort, with the people of the Beaufort Film Society. And we are going to be doing a D-Day event. It's a fundraising event for the Beaufort Film Society. So if you are anywhere in the area, come and join us. You can stay at the Beaufort Inn. It's a wonderful little hotel there. And you can join us for those events on D-Day. We've got new D-Day merchandise in our store, some specially designed t-shirts that honor everything that went on D-Day. It's the 77th anniversary. So go and check out our shop. And we got a lot of stuff coming up in the next 2 weeks.
You're super busy.
Yes, I am super busy, but I have time to talk to you today, George Shampa. I had so much fun listening to your stories last week, and you got us all the way to Battle of the Bulge. And then we just had to leave, and I've been on the edge of my seat to find out. I was told that the Battle of the Bulge was like the coldest winter in I don't know how long when you got there. And I always heard stories that you guys were not well supplied in terms of things that keep you warm. I mean, how did you, stay warm during that time?
My girlfriend. No, I'm just kidding you. I hope I don't duplicate anything I talked about before, but the Battle of Bulge, let me just tell you this, in case you don't know, that was the largest land battle the U.S. Army ever fought. And you're right, it was like 30 degrees below zero. It was a cold, cold winter, and we didn't have the clothing that we should have. I heard that there were 40,000 soldiers that had frostbitten feet. So, that battle went on from December 16th, 1944 to January 25th, 1945. So as bad as the invasion was, Normandy invasion, and it was bad, I really don't know how many were killed there, because you hear different reports, and I think it's around 8,000 that were killed. But I don't know why, but they don't have the exact figures. But I can tell you about the Battle of the Bulge. My company is 607th Graves Registration Company that got to the area in September of 1944. And we were bivouacked in an area called Homburg, H-O-M-B-O-U-R-G, Homburg, which is right next to the little village of Henri Chapelle. So at Homburg, where we had a temporary cemetery, before we left there, we had 17,300 American heroes buried there. It was on a farm. They got the land from the farmers to have the temporary cemetery there. There's a lot of pictures of the temporary cemetery with initially just markers. And then after us came another graves registration company that put wood crosses, and he had a dog tag nailed on a wood cross and one on a body. When we first got there, we were in a meadow and we dug in and we had, you know, temporary latrine. I remember that latrine.
Why?
You know what a latrine is?
I know what a latrine is, but why would it be memorable?
Because of the kind of a latrine that it was. And it was really weird.
Well, do tell. Now I'm curious.
Used for toilet paper, newspaper. But, you know, there was a shortage of toilet paper during this pandemic. People were going crazy, you know. And it kind of reminded me of us during the Battle of the Bulge. But the cemetery there, the permanent André Chappelle Cemetery, is called André Chappelle because that's the next village. Hamburg is very, very small. André Chappelle has a little church and a couple of stores. It's a very, very small village. So André, H-E-N-R-I, Chappelle, C-H-A-P-P-E-L-E, that permanent cemetery came to be in 1947, 2 years after the war. So I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to September of 44. The weather was rain, 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 cold, cold, cold. Trucks were getting stuck in the mud, having to pull them out with winches, you know, you tie onto a tree that you could find and pull yourself out of a hole that way. But it was miserable. And then it started snowing. And like everybody can tell you that lived there is still alive, it was the coldest winter they ever saw. So in the meadow, I had my foxhole. And I remember we were only there, I think, for maybe 2 or 3 days, very short time. And we thought we better move the heck out of there because we didn't have any overhead shelter, any protection from the air. And so we moved into a adjacent woods. And so the day after we moved, they bombed our temporary cemetery. The craters, wow. The craters are still there. And one of the big craters is right next to a farmhouse. And the Pooters lived in that farmhouse. It was a family of, well, there wasn't a family of 11 kids at that time, but eventually there were 11 kids. And one of them was 15 years old, and he was the oldest. And then that was Joseph. And he had two younger brothers, but I'll go into that in a bit. But the Joseph, at 15, I was 19. And so he and another kid from another village, larger, much larger village, called Obel, A-U-B-L, used to come around where bodies were being buried. And we used to tell them, get the hell out of here, kid. And they remembered those words, even 50 years later, they remember those words, get the hell out of here, kid. So anyway, Joseph, one day I said, hey, Joseph, can you bring me some milk? Oh, sure. So the next day, I'm in my, this is in, still in the meadow, by the way, right? Immediately before we got into the wooded area, there is a keg of milk right next to my foxhole. And I looked at it, there's all this hay in there. It's warm milk.
Oh.
And it's also, you know, don't you have any cold milk? No, I don't want this kind of milk. But anyway, never forget that. He never forgot that. He has died since, he died about 3 years ago, I think. But I saw him often after that. The years that we went back, I saw him and his couple of brothers and sisters. We saw a lot of the family. But the mother and father, we used to visit a lot while we were there. And I remember the bus bombs, because the Germans were launching the V-1 buzz bomb. It looks like a miniature airplane loaded with explosives. And they had thousands of those they were launching. And they were just hitting wherever. And in fact, I almost got hit by one of them. I have a piece of shrapnel that ended up right at my feet. Big piece of shrapnel, took it home. But anyway,
can I just ask you a couple of questions before we go on? Yeah. So the story that you're telling here is remarkable, and it reminds me very much of the stories that I heard in France. Here we are in Belgium, and these American GIs and the people living there sort of find a way to help each other out. And I'm wondering, how did you communicate with them? Because in France, it was challenging. How did you communicate, get me some milk?
That's interesting. There is ways of communicating if you have to. You know, we used to go in the home of his parents, Mr. and Mrs. Pooters, and sit and talk with them sometimes. And I don't know, sign language. It's a good question. I don't know how we communicated. Much later in the Army of Occupation, I know how I communicated. I learned a little German through a girl there, and she learned a little English. But we both did pretty well. I mean, I learned how to interpret the song "You Are My Sunshine" in German.
Hmm.
And I'm laughing because I went to Hawaii with American Airlines and Gary Sinise with a bunch of Pearl Harbor veterans. And after we got there, I got to meet the captain and the co-captain, Tim Knudsen and Nancy Miller, as a female co-pilot.
You have a remarkable, amazing memory to remember names.
Yeah, just sometimes. But you know what? I'm still friends with them. But what made me think of that, and see, I get off on tangents all the time. You got to bear with me on that. And my wife gets a bad at me for getting off on tangents. But I say, look, when I talk to people, none of them fall asleep. Kind of reminds me of Henry Kissinger's speech one time when he said, if I bore you, it's your fault.
So, you are not boring me, and I found your tangents interesting. So keep going.
All right. So anyway, Joseph, I said, he'd come to the cemetery and we'd have to kick him away from there. Because as I said, when we left there, we had 17,300, but this is before we had 17,300. It's early on. We're talking about December. We got strafed by a German plane, and luckily nobody got hit. We wonder why that happened on Christmas Day. But anyway, I woke up one day from my foxhole and I couldn't straighten up. I'm only, at that point, I was 19, just early on, 19 years old. So I went on sick call. I got on a truck and went to the hospital. And the first thing that happened there was they had me see a psychologist. And he asked me how I like being in the Army. And then he started asking me a bunch of stupid questions. And I just got pissed off at him and walked out. So I couldn't stand up when I went there, you know, erect. But the next day I was pretty good, because, you know, we were sleeping on the ground. You know, I was sleeping with another guy, Tex Malutin. Hicks was 24 years old when I was 19, and he was a character. And he was always smoking cigars that he'd get them home. Somehow or another, he and others got their hands on cognac. And so he'd be drinking cognac and smoking a cigar. And so pretty soon I started smoking his cigars. And pretty soon, unknowingly, he was trying to get me to quit smoking his cigars. So when I wasn't looking, he'd flip his ashes in my drink. And never bothered me, but he told me that later. Hicks died years ago from Texas, and he was really a character. He was always laughing on the outside and crying on the inside. Mm. And everybody thought he was looking for Section 8 because he'd walk around sometimes. And, if you vote for me for mayor of this town, I promise you we'll have whorehouses on wheels.
Let me ask you a practical question, and I'm sorry, this is just the way my mind works, but I'm thinking about, here you are in September, it's raining, you've dug this foxhole, there are two of you in the foxhole, and I'm still wondering the practical answers to these questions. How hard is it to dig a foxhole? B, how do two men sleep in a foxhole? C, it's raining and wet, how can you even sleep when it's so cold and wet and you two people are stuck in a hole?
Okay, let me tell you about that. We built little enclosures. We found wood around there and we built them. I had a little enclosure with my friend Tex. He was a little guy, like I was. And it was just, had an opening, just big enough that you could go in sideways. In there, we picked up a little pot stove that we got in the town there, and we had that in there. And then where we slept, we combined our shelter halves. You know a shelter half? Each soldier has a shelter half, and when you put the two halves together, you build a tent.
But we
never built the tent there. But what we did is we put the two shelters down on the ground, and then we each had a blanket. And so then we had the two blankets to put over us. And so then in the middle of the night, somebody would come in and wake me up and say, it's your turn to go on guard duty. So I would go out there in a freezing cold and I'd stand against the outhouse we had there, with my back against it with my rifle and looking this way and looking that, banging my feet together to stay, try to stay warm. I have to stand there for an hour, my turn to be on guard for 1 hour. And during that time, I got to tell you this, I looked up in the sky and there is a rocket going straight up with flame coming from the back. That was a V2. The Germans had the V2 bombs that had a long fuselage in the wings. And those things were going over to England. And when they hit in a square block, everybody had killed from the concussion. Now, we never had any of those hit us, but we had plenty of buzz bombs. It was funny because you talk about foxholes. You just happened to have a foxhole right there where three of us were standing. And here we hear this buzz bomb. And you know, the buzz bombs, they fly high. And you hear them, you hear the drone, and then all of a sudden the drone stops, then they come straight down, or they glide. Sometimes you don't even hear a drone because some of them come in at a low altitude and crash, and they're killing guys that were on piss call, that were a bit way behind the lines. And the one that almost hit us in our wooded area, all of a sudden, we're standing by this foxhole that I was telling you about, and we hear it coming because it's at low altitude. And so we all dove in the foxhole. It was funny, this guy, his name was Huff, he was a pretty heavy guy, S.S. Huff. He dove in first, and two of us dove in on top of him. And that was hilarious. But the buzz bomb hit right at the edge of our area, our trees, and exploded. And luckily, most of the shrapnel went forward, but some of it came backwards. That was this piece come flying down and landed. If it had hit me in the chest, it would have killed me, or the head. But it landed at my feet. It didn't touch me. It just landed a chunk of shrapnel about this big.
Wow.
Landed at my feet. It was all round and curly, you know, sharp edges. But anyway.
Well, can I ask you some more questions? I'm so sorry, but curious minds want to know. So what's amazing to me, and I've talked to my son Hunter about this, there is something very interesting about military humor. And so what caught me is when you're saying, you know, your friend dove in and you guys dove in on top of him and you said it was kind of funny. And here I am listening to this terrible, treacherous situation that you were able to find humor in. And I am supposing that, you know, you're stuck in this situation, you have to find ways to cope. And I mean, is that right?
Oh, yeah. My friend Tex, he found ways to cope because he was always saying these crazy things, you know. What was I going to say? The reason why it was funny, you have to see Huff, what he looks like. And he was washing out of his helmet. Okay. We use the helmets for
whore bath. Everything, I've heard, for everything.
I call them whore baths. So you use it for everything. So that's what he was doing at the time. And you got to see him. Just imagine this fat guy, Huff, that everybody used to kid him all the time. It was funny because he got in there first and we all jumped on top of him. So yeah, it was funny. If one of us got killed, it wouldn't be very funny, would it?
Right.
But the aftermath was funny. So anyway.
And then one last question. So you talked about, you got to this place where this temporary area was, and then you had this foxhole, and it sounds like you spent a lot of time making this foxhole. It sounds like, you know, you made your home away from home kind of. So I'm assuming that took a lot of digging out, but how long would you stay in this area? And would you would have to go over and make another foxhole and start all over? How much time in each area?
Well, that's a very interesting question.
Thank you.
Because we didn't stay, we did stay in that area a long time. Because what happened is the Battle of the Bows started in December. Okay, so we were there September, October, November, December, through all the rain and the snow and the cold. In that one area,
you didn't follow?
Yeah, and when we were there, we used to go, that was our home away from home. And that's where we used to go into the battlefields to pick up the bodies during the Battle of the Bulge. Okay. And now the bodies were frozen. Unlike the bodies at Normandy, that the stench was there. I told you about that got into our clothing and we're spitting all the time, dry mouths with that stench in our clothing that we slept in the foxhole. And compared to that now, we were in this area that was our home for a while. In fact, we were there for four months before we went into Germany. And then, like I said, we had 17,300 buried there when we left to go to Germany. That's when we left to go to Germany. Now, the temporary cemeteries were not built until 1947, 2 years after the war. So all of these bodies that were, first of all, they had to give this land back to the farmers. You know, they had cows on that land before we took it over, and then after we gave it back. But I did a film called They Will Never Forget. And it wasn't that film, excuse me. It was a second film called Memories of France. Oh, what the hell film was it? Anyway, Right now, the middle block. Which film was it? It had to be the first or second film, because that's the only time.
Five, by the way, those of you people that are listening.
I took teachers, I had a group of teachers, and walking over the temporary cemetery where the crosses are now all gone and the bodies are removed, because now it's like in 2007 or 8 when I went back to do documentaries. So that's when I took teachers. So in that film, you can see I'm showing teachers where the bodies, we used to lay the bodies right at the fringe of the woods there as they're being processed to be buried. And so that, I can envision that picture now, taking them there and showing them where the bodies were.
Now, I have another question. So I just saw the movie, The Battle of the Bulge. I'd never seen it before. But I had read about Malmedy. And I'm wondering, did you guys bury the people?
Yeah. Malmedy, that's where the Germans slaughtered a bunch of our prisoners that they took. And our company, I didn't get involved in that, but our company had to pick up those bodies and take them back to Henri Chapelle Temporary Cemetery. And so, yeah, that was a... And then another thing that happened, there's a lot of things I'm trying to think of what happened there, but that's one of the things that happened. I've been back there several times, by the way. There's a museum right there across from the field where these guys were all slaughtered. And in fact, after the war, the War Department came to my house, scared my mother to death, looking for me, because they had the Nuremberg trials going on. And they wanted to know what condition these bodies were in that we picked up. So I had to tell them that. And so there's a lot of things that happened while we were there. One of the little boys that used to come that would chase him away, and I saw him 50 years later, by the way, for the first time. I'll get into that in a minute. But he had a sister and a mother and father, and I knew the sister. I'll get into that in a little while. But because I kept in touch with her after the war, I studied French in college. And so I can write pretty good in French, and I can speak it, you know, so they can understand me. It's hard for me to understand what they're saying, because like us, when we're talking to them, we talk fast like this. It's hard for them to understand what we say. So you must be able to speak slowly. Lentement is the word. Doucement, lentement. Softly, slowly. Anyway, getting back to Belgium, on Christmas Day, I told you about the strafing. Another thing that was happening around Christmas, there were Germans dressed in our uniforms, spies.
I saw that in the Battle of the Bulge. I was wondering if that was really true.
Oh, yeah. We had a challenge every day. A lot of the stuff we used was baseball talk, that we all knew the baseball players who were in the World Series and all, you know. And then we knew about comics like Blondie, Dagwood. You don't know about them, but
we knew. Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Okay, so we used to challenge everybody with questions because you didn't know if they're a GI or not. And so three of these guys were caught right there in our area, and they were executed. Wow. And again, I wasn't involved in the execution, and I don't even know who was, but other GIs were involved in executing them according to the Geneva Conference. Anyone caught in your uniform, you know, can be killed right away. I mean,
what kind of questions would you ask people, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh yeah, like who was Babe Ruth? Or then we'd ask him like questions like the guys that were active playing then. I remember St. Louis had a great team, so we'd ask, who is this guy? You know, you haven't heard of Blondie?
Yeah, the cartoon.
Yeah, that's what you'd ask them. And they didn't know, well, who was her husband?
Dagwood.
So there were a lot of questions. If they flunked the first question, you give them another question, you know. But I didn't get to question these guys. But, I mean, the ones that were killed. I didn't get to question them and I didn't see them. And we were going to reenact that in my first film, but my cinematographer, the area is had all changed where they were executed. But he was with his camera and he's walking over this big berm. I thought he was going to fall down to photograph the area where these guys were killed. Then we had pictures of them, you know, there's pictures of that. And I don't know who did the photography, but there are pictures of those guys getting executed. Mm. And there was a young lady there who thought, because they were in our uniforms, they thought that our own guys were being executed.
Oh. This,
she was 18 years old. And we didn't find her. We didn't even look for her because my cinematographer, he's German descent, Wunsch, W-U-N-S-C-A. A very nice guy, by the way. And he has a company in Kansas called Outpost Worldwide. If you ever want to check his website, Outpost World. Every Veterans Day, he calls me up.
Mm.
The only guy that calls me every day on Veterans Day. And this last Veterans Day, three gay guys right here in my neighborhood took me to lunch. Palm Springs is a lot of gay guys, you know, and very few girls. The gals don't like to come here.
All right. Well, we're going off on a tangent. We're going off on a tangent, so I'm going to bring you back. So, okay. All right. So you spent a lot of months then.
One of some funny things, and here they are. Go ahead.
Yeah, so or I'd love to hear the funny things, but all I was saying is I'm taking you back. You're in Belgium. You're there for like 4 months. The Battle of the Bulge is going on. They're having to bring the people back. You were talking about the bodies being frozen, so it wasn't as bad as it was in Normandy. But what happened after you were there? What happened next?
The stench wasn't as bad.
The stench That's wasn't. Annoying.
Yeah. Well, right here behind me, you can't see it, I was going to just say one of the most important commendations, if that's what you want to call it. You ever see a guy wearing a gold wreath on the sleeve down here by the wrist? It's like a wreath. That is a Meritorious Service Award, and we got that award. Our whole company of 124 enlisted men and officers, we got that award because when there was a standstill when we first got there in September. It looked like the Germans were pretty much defeated, not like it after Normandy with Paris. It looked like the war was over. But the Germans, that's the Battle of the Bulge, that's their breakthrough coming back from Germany after they had withdrawn. Now, in force, we come back, which is called the Battle of Buzz because it's an encirclement. And a lot of our divisions withdrew for better position. We had to stay there with the medics. Medics and Graves Administration had to stay there. And we could have been encircled. It could have come around behind us, and we would have been in the bulge. So... yeah, so that battle, you know, I did in my first film, I talked about War with 11, which was 11 black soldiers who were in the artillery. There weren't too many in there. These guys were artillery. And so they withdrew, and they only had one rifle and no food, and it was a cold, cold winter. And we were right on the border. Werwolf is a little village right on the border of Belgium and Germany. And they found themselves in this little village. And the family there took them in and got them warmed and fed. And some snitch turned them in. Mm-hmm. And so here comes the SS guys. And they took these guys out in the cold. Had them sit down in the cold, and I didn't know what to do with them. So they marched them in front of their vehicles. They brutalized these guys, 11 guys.
Oh.
And they threw them in a ditch, and they were covered with snow. The farmer there he put a little wood cross in that area, which was there a long time. Finally, they put a monument for those 11 soldiers. And there was a teacher there. She died a long time ago, but she was in our film. And she's talking about these 11 Black soldiers who were killed. We buried those guys in our temporary cemetery, but seven of them went home. They were sent back in a casket like the others to the family wherever they want them buried in any cemetery at no cost. And the other four are Henri Chapelle. And every year they have a ceremony there. They have, I met a couple of Black generals and people from the administration at the time that came there. So the ceremonies that go on there every year in September for these 11 soldiers. So I covered that because what we did, we went back and we saw the lady that lived in the house at the time. She was 18 years old. And she tells us in German, because and we're with a lot of people were German sympathizers and others were not. And so you didn't know who your friend was and who wasn't because somebody turned them into the SS. Anyway, we interviewed her and in my film, it's we have subtitles. And she was, when we interviewed her, she was the same age as I was. And I was 81 when I did my first film called Lesson is Priceless.
Well, the name of your first film is The Lesson is Priceless?
Yeah, it's prefaced by Let Freedom Ring. The Lesson is Priceless because we had four young history teachers that I took. One of them, three of them were young ladies and one was a young man. And they had the opportunity to talk to people who had lost their freedom. And then they show that film to their kids and these are history teachers, by the way. They show their kids every year, the different kids, that film. And I go there and talk to the kids. And so.
So let me ask you real quick, if somebody is listening to this and they want to go and watch your movie, Let Freedom Ring, The Lesson is Priceless, where can they find that movie right now?
Well, my website is being reconstructed, but I still think they can get there. Because the reason it's being reconstructed is because now I'm selling my films to past supporters for $15 and no cost for mailing or handling. And that's coming. The film is just being reconstructed, but they might be able to see a part of it. They could buy it there. They could go to letfreedomringfor.org. That's letfreedomringfor.org. Or they can send me an email, george@letfreedomringforall.org.
Great. Thank you.
And anyway, we covered that with this lady, told us the whole story. And then a couple of years later, Hollywood got involved. And these guys did a story on it. And in their trailer, they said, for the first time, this story is being told. And so I got a hold of the director. And I said, wait a minute, that's nice what you're doing, but it's not the first time this story. Oh, he says, I don't know who you are. I'm going to talk to my attorney, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, nothing ever came of it, you know, got dropped. But they did a recreation of this. And my friends in Belgium that have the Remember Museum, that's a good website to go to, the Remember Museum, 1939-1945. But the Remember Museum is also on my website too. But they're terrific people. And they have a museum that's like no other because it's very personalized. The man, Marcel and Matilda. And Matilda's younger than he is. He was a bachelor until he met her. He was a body and defender guy. What happened there is when the Battle of the Bulge started, all these guys from the 1st Division that were bivouacked on their grounds, at that farm, the farmhouse, they left a lot of stuff there. So we used a lot of this stuff for a little museum in his house, in an attachment, like a big garage to his house. Now he's got a big museum there and wonderful things there. And he's very mechanical. First of all, there's a flagpole American flag. There's a Sherman tank that he rebuilt that was left there by our troops at the end of the war. All of us, that's how all these reenactors get all of our stuff, because we left it there. You know,
there's so much stuff we left there that reenactors in every country have wrapped up and taken care of.
Some guys made a lot of money, you know, reselling stuff. But anyway, it's another story. But that tells you exactly, this lady tells you exactly what happened there. And so eventually a monument got put there. And I mentioned it earlier, I've met Black generals from there and other people. And it's cold, always really cold. So September is cold. And they do that in memory of these soldiers that were killed.
I appreciate you telling that story, because honestly, I've never heard it, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners haven't either. So thank you for telling us that story. You know, I think everybody should go and look at George's website and try to find his films, order him from him, email him. He's got 5 of them. And George,
six of them.
So
done in Normandy, as you know, in 2019.
I'm forgetting that one. That's right. We were there together.
Exactly.
So you guys can go to his website, letfreedomringforall.org, and you'll see all of his work there. And, you know, it's important work for everybody to watch. And George, we want to talk to you. You know, I think we're going to have you come back, because we're still not out of Battle of the Bulge. And I am wondering, like, when did you leave this temporary cemetery and what happened after that? Now, we only have probably about 8 more minutes left.
Okay, let me talk fast. What happened is we left there in February to go to Germany. Our last temporary, we had 17 temporary cemeteries throughout France, Belgium, and Germany. So when we left there and went into Germany, we ended up in Eisenach, Germany, which is about 100 miles from Berlin. And we had temporary cemetery there. When the war ended on May 8th, 1945, when the war ended, I celebrated with 2 bottles of wine, 1 red, 1 white. But what happened is we had to disinter a cemetery at Eisenach, and had to handle the remains and put the remains, first identify them to make sure you're identifying them with a cross, the dog tag on the temporary cross and dog tag on the body. And then you had to put in boxes and ship to Holland and Belgium to be put in other temporary cemeteries. And they weren't put in caskets until 2 years after the war, when the permanent cemeteries were built. And they were put in lined caskets, the remains, bones. And the people who did that were the natives who lived there, the civilians who lived there, who were paid to do that. And so the next of kin had the prerogative of having the remains of their loved one sent back to the U.S. at no cost to them, any cemetery they wanted, or remain there. Now, excuse me, what remained there is 40% of those who were killed, because the other 60% were returned home. So when you see a permanent cemetery over there, like Normandy, with about almost 10,000 graves, that only represents 40% of what was there.
Right.
Like Louis Chappelle was 17,300 when we left, and then there were more bodies buried there after we left. And so of all of those bodies, the 17,300 plus, 40% of them are buried in caskets in the new Henri Chappelle beautiful cemetery. And those cemeteries over there are beautiful, all of them, better than the ones here. By far, because they're all white marble imported from Italy. And what's on those crosses and Stars of David? Date of birth?
Nope. No. Date of death.
Date of death, which is approximated, that I know. And I learned that 50 years later when I went back to Normandy for the first time and saw that there was no date of birth. I think we talked about this before. That upset me because people visiting the cemetery have no idea who the soldier was. How old was he? Was he married? Did he have any kids or anything? You don't know nothing. But you know what? The people over there, many of the people are discovering that information. Many of them have websites. And in Holland, they're fantastic. In Holland, there's 8,300 Americans buried in that Margraten Cemetery. And every one of those graves has been adopted. And the pillars with names of the missing in action, every one of those has been adopted long ago. And in many cases, who adopted it has been handed down to the next generation, who goes there from time to time with flowers. And they don't have to do anything maintaining it, you know, work-wise. I mean, we have people doing that over there that are paid to do it. And every cemetery, the permanent cemetery built by the American Battle Monuments Commission, who maintains them, they have a supervisor and an assistant supervisor who live at each cemetery. So well taken care of. And if I had been killed, that's where I would want to be buried, except my mother would have my remains come home, I'm sure, you know.
Sure.
Anyway, how much more time do we have?
Well, we're almost out, but I mean, seriously, we are going to have it. Can you come back next week?
I think so.
Because I still want to find out after the war. I want to know, you know, where you were from like February to May. And then I know for 7 months you stayed in Germany after that. And I haven't heard a lot about, you know, what that was like. So,
well, I can tell you some stuff in there that you might think is funny.
Yeah.
I can tell you about my girlfriend that I had that was on a flying trapeze there in Germany. I can tell you about my Jeep that I had illegally. And I can tell you about following her all over Germany in places like Heidelberg and Heilbronn and Karlsruhe and Stuttgart, and taking her home to Frankfurt and getting caught by the MPs there.
Okay. All right, stop right there. That is enough of a tease for our audience for them to come back next week. Next week when we come back, everybody, we're going to talk to George about the end of the war, where he was, you know, at the very end, what he did during the sustainment period. And if we have time, we'll talk to him about his life post-war. If we don't have time, we're going to have him come back the following week, because as I know, you know, listening to George is such an honor and a treasure. I don't want to rush through these stories. And I know our audience listening to these, you are teaching us so many new things, George, and it is very, very rare for anybody to sit down and listen to a World War II soldier who can tell to this detail what they remember. So we just appreciate you so much sharing these stories with us. And we thank you so much for making time and coming back. You're an amazing person. And
you know, I'm going to be 96 on June 16th.
It's unbelievable.
I'm going to tell you how I escaped being court-martialed because I had a Jeep illegally for 7 months. Okay.
Yes, I mean, we're going to have a great, I can't wait till next week because, I mean, Jason, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing that story.
I mean, Jason, let me ask you, you're a young guy, you know, you probably haven't had a lot of World War II history. What is it like listening to George tell his stories?
Well, it's amazing because I grew up with, my grandparents were both born in the 30s. You know, my grandparents, who like really talked about the war a lot, were both born in the mid 30s. And so, you know, they remember Pearl Harbor, they remember all these events. And I remember being a kid listening to them talk about it. And just from them, you know, they were kids when they went through it. And so it's amazing to hear someone who lived through the events, not hearing about them just as the news, but actually was there. And it just brings a whole new gravity to, you know, my grandmother lost a cousin, went down to Lexington, and, you know, just hearing these stories from someone who lived it, is absolutely incredible. And so, George, I want to thank you so much for coming on today and last week and hopefully next week to just tell us about this.
Just quickly, my late wife, who died in 1981 and had the two children by her, she and my kids never heard any of these stories. My kids now, my daughter's 51. She has two kids, one a little autistic girl and a son, 12 and 15. And they have a son who's gay. And they live in Colorado. And they've never heard these stories. Hmm. Now, my wife is that I'm married to now, you know, married Dottie in 1991. It's 10 years after my wife died, because I raised my kids for 10 years. And that's, I'm most proud of that than anything, because my daughter was 11 and my son was 10. And so I'll let you go with that. I know my time's up and I don't want to overdo it. So we'll see you next week.
Yeah, we are so blessed by you, George. And, you know, if you're listening to this and you have enjoyed these stories of George's as much as I have, I would love for you to write me, Christian@NormandyStories, and just tell me what it's meant to you listening to George's stories. I want to read some of these to George next week. So shoot me a note, Christian@NormandyStories, and let me know what you think about these stories. Also, could you leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you listen to podcasts? We could really use some reviews for our podcast. So anyway, Jason, I'm going to let you take us out. Please make sure to visit the Girly War freedom.com. We are still taking donations. There's a donate button there, and we really appreciate it. Those go to our operating costs, and eventually I hope to get enough supporters so I can pay Jason for showing up every week. So yeah, Jason, I'm turning it over to you.
Well, thank you for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everyone has a story to tell and you can be the one to tell it.
Yes, you can. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you so much for listening, for donating, and for following along on our journey. If you are able to make a donation this week, we would really appreciate it. We are supported by donors who give us $100 or less, so anything helps. Also, if you're able to share the news about the Girl Who Wore Freedom with your friends and family, please do that on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or email. And sign up for our newsletter at thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. Please go to thegirlwhowarefreedom.com/donate to make a donation today.